So again, in the afternoon sessions, this one and the next, we're going in meditation, we're in the Vipassana practice, and so the last 2 days we've been applying our mindfulness with respect to the body, because that's what's recommended as a beginning point, because it's most easy. In the four applications of mindfulness, the body was coming first, and then the next two is feelings and mind. So that's what we're going to be focusing on today, because of course also the mind is the focal point of Mahamudra practice. And again, today we're going to work at a foundation level. So remember, Mahamudra is about realizing emptiness. Today we're going to work at the foundation level, focusing on the mind in terms of these three marks of existence: impermanence, dukkha, and no self. So we are going to, in this meditation, focus on the mind as we do in the shamatha practice, just observing the mind, whatever's arising, watching it arise and pass. And in particular here, when we do that, we're going to, whatever we observe in the mind, we're going to look and notice if this is something stable or whether it's something changing and transient. So that's what we're going to do initially. And then in the second half of the meditation, and I'll mention that in the middle of the meditation, we're then going to still, of course, observe the mind and whatever is present. And then whatever is arising in our mind, we're going to look at it and see, is this in the nature of happiness or not? The second idea of dukkha. And then in the next meditation this afternoon, we're going to look at whatever's arising in the mind. Is there anywhere there a self, a me, an observer to be found? So that's in the next meditation. So this one, primarily, we're going to look at, are these mental events stable or are they transient? And then in the second half, is any of this in the nature of happiness? Okay, so let's do that meditation and then we'll go back into the text. Begin by, of course, preparing the body, setting it into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. preparing the mind, setting it into a state of ease and relaxation, allowing it to settle into the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And bring your attention to your own mind. And observe your own mind and whatever is arising in the mind. Without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of thoughts. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness. Without grasping to any mental events, without becoming distracted. Also noticing whatever appears in the mind, whether it's stable or changing and transient. continue to observe whatever arises in the mind. And now ask the question of whatever appears in the mind, is this in the nature of happiness or not? Or is it in the nature of dukkha? Does it have the potential for suffering inbuilt in it? Now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest, resting in awareness itself. Simply be present. Simply be aware of being aware. Without doing anything at all. Just be. So we're currently, in the text, we're looking at how to progress along the nine mental abidings using the six powers. So we're looking at this diagram here, how we progress along the stages to shamatha. Remember, we saw that the elephant is the mind. The fact that it's black is dullness or laxity. The monkey is conceptual thought. The fact that it's black is excitement. The meditator with the two tools, the rope of mindfulness in their left hand, the hook of introspection in their right. And we saw that at the first stage, setting the mind, what we notice is that the mind is completely out of control, that we're very rarely on the object. Most of the time we are distracted. And that if we continue to practice, we'll get around to the second stage called continuous setting. Here, the elephant monkey not running so fast, meaning that now we're starting to be able to focus on the object a little bit better. So instead of a few seconds, maybe now by the second stage, we can focus on the object for maybe a minute or two before we're distracted. But even at the second stage, we are distracted a lot more than we are on the object. And then if we continue, we'll get around to the third stage. So the third and fourth stage are on this road. The third road here is the road of mindfulness. So by the third and fourth stage now, our mindfulness is getting a lot better. So let's have a look at in Daniel P. Brown's book, what he says about the third and fourth stage. He said, the third and fourth of the nine stages, resetting and setting closely, correspond to the third straight road, known as the road of mindfulness. Because now the meditator rarely completely loses track of the intended object. At the resetting stage, that's the third one, the meditator is able to recognize distraction more immediately after it has occurred and is able to redirect the mind back to the intended object with less forcible effort. This is symbolized at the third stage here. We see that the rope of mindfulness now is tied to the elephant in the mind. Mindfulness getting a lot better. And we see the elephant has the head turned backwards, and that is symbolizing the fact that we, when we're distracted, we quickly recognize that and quickly come back to the object. So that's with the elephant turning the head backwards. And then he says, recovery of focus occurs shortly after becoming distracted. There is much greater continuity to the mind's ability to stay on the intended object over time. So here we can probably stay on the object 5 or 10 minutes at a time, and then if we get distracted, we quickly come back. The main problem at this stage, however, is the problem of patchy or partial staying, in which a part of the mind strays on the intended object while the rest of the mind engages in mental elaboration. So here, and you probably noticed this already, you're focusing on the breath and you're thinking about breakfast at the same time. Often to the point where the main focus is breakfast, and a little bit on the corner of your mind, you're still holding on to the breath. So this is what he's talking about here. Therefore, the meditator is at the risk of developing the illusion of staying continuously on the meditative object. Because we're always a little bit on the object, we may think, oh yes, I'm on the object all the time, when actually a large percentage of our mind is not on the object. Therefore, the meditator, redirecting the mind, intensifying to stay on the intended object and or focusing in more refined details on the intended object are the typical methods for overcoming patchy staying. The resultant staying is both more continuous over time and more complete, less patchy at any given moment. The other thing we can see at stage three here is the rabbit on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing subtle dullness, subtle laxity. By the third stage now, as he said, we can hold the object quite well for longer periods, and when we get distracted, we quickly come back. So we may be under the illusion that, you know, we're nearly at shamatha because we're holding the object quite well. But actually, one of the problems here is that our mind is still not sharp and clear. So we need to recognize now that our mind is a little bit dull, not very sharp, and correct that. If we don't recognize that, then we're going to get stuck here. So that's the rabbit, symbolized subtle dullness. We need to start to recognize when our mind is a little bit dull and fix that up. Then the fourth stage, he says the following. At the fourth stage, staying closely, the meditator has developed very powerful mindfulness. Now our mindfulness is getting very good so that we can really hold the object the entire session without really ever completely losing it. So that staying is relatively continuous and complete, and he or she rarely fully loses track of the intended object. It is called staying closely because staying is more complete, less partial. The main problems at this stage are coarse flightiness and dullness and their derivatives, sleepiness and heaviness. Coarse level dullness actually seems to increase at this stage because concentration is much more inward than outward. So by the fourth stage, we can hold the object the entire session without really ever completely losing it. Our mindfulness is getting quite good, but still we have a lot of work to do on the quality of our attention. So then we go around to the fifth and sixth stage. So we have another road here. This is the road of introspection. Now on the fifth and sixth stage, we're using the power of introspection to notice these flaws in our concentration, that even though we're not completely lost the object, we've still got some agitation, we still have some dullness. So we need to start to refine our attention to overcome these imbalances. So often here at this stage, and we see now the hook of introspection is more prominent, and often at this stage there's an analogy given about the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. So here over these stages now, we are constantly fine-tuning our focus, overcoming some little subtle dullness and subtle agitation. So we're constantly fine-tuning over these following stages. So let's see what he says here about stage 5 and 6. The fifth and sixth stage of the nine stages, disciplining and calming, correspond to the fourth straight road, the road of introspection. The three turns between each of the first four straight roads are negotiated by the flame of intensifying, meaning we need to put effort to move forward. Intensifying is vitally important because it affects the shift from road of hearing to road of reflecting, from the road of reflecting to road of mindfulness, and from the road of mindfulness to road of introspection. So by putting effort, we're continually improving our mindfulness and introspection. Once attaining the road of introspection, the meditator rarely loses track of the intended object. Along this road, concentration is pleasurable and uplifting, and at times intensely blissful. During the fifth stage, disciplining, course-level flightiness settles down, but subtle dullness is very strong. Therefore, the meditator needs to use introspection to recognize it. So this is the rabbit. We see it also at stage 5. And use intensification to eradicate it in a disciplined manner. The practitioner must stay very alert and keep the mind bright and sharp. At the sixth stage, calming, subtle dullness has disappeared. So we see no rabbit anymore at stage 6. So subtle dullness is now gone. But subtle flightiness, so that's subtle agitation, remains a problem. And so that is the monkey. So we still see the monkey at stage 6. It's still a bit of a problem. But subtle flightiness remains a problem, in part because the ordinary mind remains habitually attached to sensory experiences, in part because the meditative mind has become attached to the uplifting sense of the road of introspection. So now the practice is becoming enjoyable and blissful, and so now we're starting to get a bit of craving and attachment for this, and so this is agitating the mind a little bit. And in part because in order to get this far, the practitioner has held the mind very tightly. Thus, at this stage, the skill is to calm subtle flightiness. So this subtle agitation because of holding and also the blissful attachment to a bit of bliss. But then when we go around the corner, we now at stage 7 and 8 in the next two stages. And here we see goodbye to the monkey. So this subtle agitation now we're saying goodbye to, and now the flame has disappeared and the black is virtually disappeared on the elephant. So now things become much more effortless and we can stay longer and longer, more and more clearly on the object. So let's see what he says here for this. The seventh and eighth stage of the nine stages correspond to the fifth straight road, the road of perseverance. Along this road, the meditator has sustainable energy to continue meditating for long periods without distraction or fatigue and without any course-level flightiness or dullness. So here at stage 7 and 8, as I said earlier at the beginning, we need to have very short sessions and then increase them as we go. By stage 7 and 8, we can now meditate for long periods of time very clearly. It's said at stage 7 and 8, no problem to meditate 2 or 3 hours in one stretch. No problem at all. Where are we? At the seventh stage, thorough calming, neither subtle flightiness nor dullness pose any real risk, but the meditator is still distracted by these states. Both mindfulness and introspection operate automatically. So we see no flame anymore. They become really spontaneous. We don't need put effort with little need to do anything to bring them about. However, at the seventh stage, the meditator still needs to apply considerable effort to keep the mind, to get the mind to stay continuously and completely, and must continue to apply such effort until it becomes automatic. During the eighth stage, one-pointedness. So remember earlier we said that shamatha is achieved through non-equipoise mind, which was the first seven stage unbalance. Now we have eighth stage, one-pointed concentration. It says here, effort is only needed to set up the meditation session. So we only need a little bit of effort to start, and then the whole session becomes effortless. And he says, but it becomes automatic after that. So we only need a little bit of effort to start, and then it's spontaneous and automatic. Single point of concentration. At this point, the meditator is confident that easing up on the effort will not cause distraction from the intended object, nor will subside, nor will subtle dullness or flightiness be a problem. So we see there's no black left on the elephant of the mind, so not a problem anymore. Concentration is never interrupted moment by moment for the entire meditation session and flows continuously and automatically. Sounds pretty good. So let's have a look now at ninth stage. Ninth stage here is called setting in equipoise or balance. And here he says the ninth stage, equanimity, he calls it, or balance, corresponds to the sixth road, the road of mastery. At this final stage, staying is complete and continuous, and events arise with intense clarity. So now it becomes all effortless, and we have brilliant clarity of attention. It is also effortless and spontaneous, and great mental pliancy is developed. Mastery of both the ninth stage and mental pliancy leads to mastery over calming staying practice. The signs of genuine mastery include continuous meditative stabilization during both waking and sleep, being done with coarse level appearances and negative emotional states during meditation, the sense of having acquired a new body upon waking from meditation, the occurrence of pure illusion-like appearances and meditative visions. Sounds pretty good. But we still haven't achieved shamatha. So shamatha here, the top in the middle, is from the ninth stage, as he mentioned, then being in that ninth stage, then we have what's called, we achieve this physical and mental pliancy, flexibility and serviceability of mind. And that is symbolized at shamatha here, with the person flying through the air. That is this physical pliancy. He talks here about that you arise in meditation and it feels like you've acquired a new body. And often it's said that your body feels light like cotton. And also mental pliancy or flexibility means now your mind is completely flexible and serviceable. You can direct your mind to whatever you want without any resistance. And that's symbolized by the meditator riding on the elephant of the mind, directing it wherever he wants to go. So let's have a look now at how we transition from the ninth stage to shamatha. And this is very clearly described in Alan Wallace's book, The Attention Revolution. So let's have a look at that. What he says, this transition. Following the realization of the ninth stage of attentional balance, you are primed to achieve shamatha. The nine preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, the first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point. But so far, no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated with gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy in which your mind is fit and subtle like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional, it is prone to laxity and excitation. It is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task. And such a mind is now set to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimal mental performance. Following this sense of pressure on the top of the head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving in your body. And when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you were filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed of physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before. So that's again symbolized by the person flying through the sky. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides, and you are freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and clarity. You have now achieved shamatha. Sounds pretty good. Does anyone have any questions about the nine stages? There's one or two more things I want to mention about the diagram, but anything about the nine stages that anyone would like to ask? Why a rabbit? I don't know. I mean, there's probably some reason for the various animals according to historical culture, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure why they use the rabbit for subtle dullness. I'm sure there's usually a pretty good reason. I've not heard any description about why using a rabbit.
Chance to meet somebody who reached some higher stages of this shamatha meditation?
Yeah. Of course, in general, people who even develop high levels of shamatha tend to, of course, that subdues mental afflictions, even, I mean, we don't get rid of it, but you find that someone who's developed a high level here will be very calm and focused and often very humble, and they're not going around boasting about the things they did. So you won't find people going around saying, oh, you know, I'm at stage eight, you know. Usually if people do that, you can pretty well sure that they're just deluding themselves, yeah. So that's one thing. But there was a case, maybe some of you know him because it's public knowledge, is Venerable René. He's a Swiss monk. He's in the Gelug tradition, and I think he's in the US still. And he spent quite a lot of effort doing shamatha practice. He a few years retreat in Spain and other places, and he still now primarily does a lot of retreat. And some years ago, Lama Zopa, who I think is one of his teachers, sort of wanted to know what sort of level he was at. So he got him to both he and then Chödön Rinpoche, who's passed away now, was also known as a very high meditator. And Venerable René was explaining his experiences to them, and they basically said he was about stage six or seven in the chart. That's where he was. I think stage seven. was where he was at. So, yeah. Okay, just...
And all these farms, they are gradually, so they don't mix.
Okay, good. Good question. So what does it mean to be at a particular level? So remember, let's take an example. Level 3 means you can normally focus 5 or 10 minutes, and then if you get distracted, you quickly come back. It could be that you have a session now where you have that. It could actually be that now you have a session where you're focused on the breath the whole session, which is stage 4. Does that mean you're at stage 4? No. If your normal average experience is that you can hold the object the entire session without ever losing it, if that's your average experience, then you're at stage 4. So within a stage, sometimes, like if you're at stage 3 where normally you can hold 5 or 10 minutes and then if you're distracted quickly back, if that's your normal experience, then you're stage 3. But it could be that in a particular meditation, sometimes you can hold the object the entire session. Then you may be at stage 4 or even 5 in that meditation. And then another meditation, you may be a bit more distracted and you may actually only be like stage 2 experience. So, but if your average experience is that, that's what it means to be at that stage. So you can sort of oscillate a little bit either side of that stage you're at. And also, of course, if you're at a particular stage and you stop practicing, you don't stay there. It's a bit like if you go to the gym and you get a certain level of fitness and then you stop going to the gym, you're not going to stay at that level of fitness. So if you get to stage 4 or 5 or whatever, and then you stop practicing, slowly you're going to go backwards. But like going to the gym, if you reach a certain, you may need to have a lot of effort to reach a certain level, but then to maintain that level, you need a minimum amount of effort to maintain that level. So similarly here. And of course, if you put more effort, you can move forward. So it's a little bit like that.
We're talking about René Pussy.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, one or two more things about the diagram of interest. First point is, over on the side here, there's a monkey in a tree and number 19 underneath it. And if we go back on the opposite page and read out what number 19 says, it says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. So normally, of course, we're trying to cultivate virtuous thoughts like compassion and loving kindness and bodhicitta. But if in the middle of your shamatha practice, observing the breath, say, you're having some virtuous thought, then you need to let it go and come back to the breath.
It's a distraction.
It's a distraction, exactly. Of course, outside of meditation, we need to cultivate these. And this is something that's going to happen as we start to go deeper into the practice. What you're going to find is that the more we go into this practice, the more calm and peaceful and focused our mind becomes, the more space opens up for great ideas to come up. Particularly if you have some problem that you've been trying to resolve and you haven't got a solution, it's very common in the middle of this shamatha meditation for the answer to come up. And it's very common for some great ideas to come up in the middle of meditation. But as said here, that's a distraction. Let it go and come back to the object. So then if some great idea comes up in the middle of meditation, then just go, very good, I'll attend to that after the meditation and go back to the object. If you're worried about forgetting this great idea, have a little notepad, jot down one or two key words and then go back. Because if you keep following them, you'll find you'll get blocked because the more we progress, the more these things come up because there's more space for them to arise. You'll find that you get more and more great ideas, more and more creativity will surface because of the shamatha practice. So that's one thing to be aware of. Just let it go and look at and have... and entertain that great creative idea after the meditation, not in the middle of the meditation. So that's one point I wanted to mention. The other one is, If we go up to the top right-hand corner, we see one last diagram. We see now the meditator on the elephant of the mind, and in their right hand is a sword. This is a sword of wisdom. So this is symbolizing the Vipassana practice. And now we see the flame again, which means now we need to put effort on the basis of shamatha and in the Vipassana practice using the sword of wisdom to cut through ignorance. And we see here two numbers, 32 and 33. And if we look at what they say, it says, the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana, observing emptiness. Equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So that's what we've seen in this text, is first achieve shamatha and engage in vipassana practice. And that if we have shamatha and vipassana unified, we can come to realize emptiness directly. Now, what this does not mean, of course, is that we have to achieve shamatha before we begin our vipassana practice. If we do that, we're probably never going to start any vipassana practice. What it does mean is that as a beginner, if we put no effort into the shamatha practice, we can put a lot of effort into vipassana and get really nowhere because we're completely distracted and dull. So, yes, it does mean as a beginner, particularly if we are very distracted and dull, we need to put quite a lot of effort into the shamatha to stabilize the mind, make it more clear, and then engage in vipassana practice as well, and then continue to engage in both of them. And then eventually, once we achieve shamatha, we can unify that with vipassana and we can come to a direct realization of emptiness. Because even in vipassana practice, if we have some taste or experience of emptiness in meditation, we won't be able to gain a direct realization of emptiness until we achieve shamatha, because our mind is not stable and clear enough to get to that level of realization. At best, we would have some taste or experience of emptiness, which would be very helpful, but it'll wear off. So therefore, if we want to get our vipassana practice to the point of a direct realization of emptiness, then we really need to have the shamatha. So those were the two points I wanted to add to the chart. And that's all I wanted to mention on the chart. We still got a couple of minutes before the tea break, so any last questions about anything here? Yeah. Okay. I'll give the short answer now, because if we look in the very next sentence in the text, on page 5 at the top, it says, through focusing on what type of object of meditation does one cultivate concentration? So that's actually the very next topic we're going to look at in the next session. But the short answer to your question is, yes, to achieve shamatha, we need eventually a mental object, because as we go along these 9 stages and as our concentration improves, actually our sense faculties begin to shut down. So you won't be able to notice physical sensations of the breath after some point. Fortunately, if you're using the breath as the object, before that happens, what's called the acquired sign, which is a mental image that spontaneously arises that's related to the air element. That mental image can be very diverse depending on the individual person. But when that mental image arises, it's not something you generate, it spontaneously arises due to your focus on the breath. When that comes up, you switch from the sensations to the mental image of that, and you continue with that to shamatha. So you can use the breath all the way to shamatha, but not the physical sensations. So yes, you eventually have to move to a mental object, yes. But a little bit more to be said about that in the next session.
A question about the last meditation.
Yeah.
We should say that we we should ask the question, is the object
in the nature of happiness or transient? Yeah.
Sure. Is it like the analytical meditation in this case? That I think of snow, for example.
Yeah. I mean, analytical meditation means to analyze, to investigate, and that may involve going through some logical steps to come to some conclusion, or it may simply involve looking directly, you know, analyzing, investigating directly, and that's what we're doing in this case. We don't need to go through any logical steps to come to some sort of conclusion. We just use analysis or investigation by looking directly at the nature of what we see in front of us. Like impermanence, you know, we can say that's an analytical meditation because we're analyzing, we're investigating the nature of those experiences. But we don't need to go through some logical thinking. We just look directly and see, yes, it's arising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing. Likewise, is this in the nature of happiness? We look directly at that experience. Is that in the nature of happiness or not? And similarly, with the next meditation we're going to do, is having a look, is that which is appearing, is that the self? We're not, again, going through some intellectual process. So in this case, we are simply investigating by looking directly at... Yes, of course. I mean, often because we often in our... The way we live is we always want an intellectual answer to things. And we've often lost our ability to directly observe. We always want to intellectualize things. And that here, in this case, would be an obstacle. So again, we have to... You know, even focusing on the breath, often people have the habit of visualizing the breath, imagining the breath, all of these things, which is an obstacle in this case. Similarly here, and that's why I emphasized earlier this morning, this bare attention. Just look directly. Okay. So time for another break and come back at 5:00. And then we'll start with another Vipassana meditation, and then we'll go on to the text again and looking at the various objects we can use in the shamatha practice.